Hi, this is Newt. Due to the virus, I'm recording from home, so you may notice a difference in audio quality. On this episode of Newt's World, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak in the United States is in New York, and it's particularly concentrated in the New York City region. As of May 28th, New York State has 369,801 confirmed cases and 29,339 deaths. Most of those cases are in New York City, with 204,781 confirmed cases and 20,844 deaths. Why is New York the epicenter of the virus? Did the lack of leadership from New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio contribute to increasing the virus spread? I'm pleased to welcome my guest, Dr. Betsy McCoy, author of The Next Pandemic and former Lieutenant Governor of New York from 1995 to 1998. I'm really delighted to have a personal friend, somebody who I admire enormously, Betsy McCoy, join us to talk about her new book, The Next Pandemic. In the book, Betsy shows how to battle the next pandemic without an economic shutdown, including technologies to make workplaces safer, healthier, have protection for hospital workers, and cut dependence on China for medical supplies. I have been amazed at the news media's unwillingness to tell the truth about New York State. New York was the epicenter of death, not because of bad luck, but because of really bad judgment. So let me turn to Betsy and let her walk us through what she's learned and what she knows, because she's one of the great experts at taking apart data and making sense out of it. So Betsy, what's your whole reaction to the New York experience?
Well, it isn't shocking because I've spent so much time in Albany, but I have to tell you, it wasn't even a matter of bungling or bad judgment. We've seen some of that during the pandemic. It's inevitable that health officials, governors will make some mistakes in this unprecedented event. But this wasn't a mistake. This was a sellout. Big difference. This was a sellout to the single industry that controls Albany, that gives the most money to the governor's campaign committees, over $1 million in 2018, his last election cycle. This is the hospital industry pulling the strings, regardless of what the impact will be on nursing home residents. And in this case, it was a very deadly impact. The problem was that back in early March, hospitals started to really fill up with COVID-19 patients. The hospital industry said to the governor, we have to clear out these elderly patients. They're in here for 2 or 3 weeks at a time on ventilators, not to mention the fact that the hospital isn't getting paid for such long duration under the Medicare system. But anyway, these elderly patients are blocking our beds. They're still infected, but we've got to send them out of here into nursing homes that have empty beds. So to swing that, the hospitals actually had to get rid of a safety regulation that required patients to test negative for this infection twice before going to a nursing home. The state health department willingly complied. They just kowtowed to the industry because of the huge amount of money at stake. And that's why all these nursing home residents are dying, because the state health department and the governor picked money over lives.
That's astonishing. So do you think that the hospital association realized how profoundly wrong?
The day the mandate was announced, patient advocates from all over the country urged them not to do it. The Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths, my organization, issued a statement that day saying, please don't do this. It will be a death sentence. The American Healthcare Association, representing doctors and nursing home operators, said, please don't do it. Health professors from Harvard Medical School said, this is a recipe for disaster. But they did it anyway and stuck to it until May because of the money.
So in your view, this was literally Cuomo selling out senior citizens in New York.
Yes, his biggest donor, his mega donor, the Greater New York Hospital Association. And he sold out for that reason. There's no question about it. And Then, to cover up the carnage, the state health department quietly changed how it was calculating who's dying in a nursing home. Every state counts both those who die in the home and those who are sent to the hospital and then succumb to the illness. They quietly changed those figures so that they could slice in half what the actual death toll is. And that's why, as we speak this week, it's 12,000, not 6,000. Of course, every life matters, but the fact is the consequences of this very venal decision are twice as bad as the state has admitted.
Are people beginning to admit to that number now?
I had a back and forth with the state health department press office until I finally got them to admit, yes, it's a different way of calculating it now. It's clear that the death toll is far higher once you count the number of people who have gone to the hospital first. And all you have to do is look at the records in other states and the record in New York before the change was made to realize it's about double. Across the nation, about 51% of all the deaths related to the coronavirus are nursing home residents.
Here you have a governor deliberately lying to his state about the fate of their grandparents.
And it wasn't the first lie, and it's not the last lie. Last week, he tried to pin it on the Trump administration, claiming that federal agencies had ordered the state to make this mandate that patients from hospitals be admitted to nursing homes, even if they're still infected with the coronavirus. Of course, that's not true. Not at all. In fact, the CDC on March 18th warned in their monthly newsletter, warned the states, do everything you can to prevent COVID from entering a nursing home.
I thought it was fascinating because when I saw Governor Cuomo blaming the Trump administration and saying, hey, don't blame me, I went to Vice President Pence's task force and said, what's the deal? They promptly sent me the statement that was sent out by Seema Verma. What they had issued as guidance was the opposite of what Cuomo was doing. So on the one hand, he adopts a rule which guarantees that a substantial number of grandparents in New York will die. Then he modifies the reporting rule to minimize our ability to realize how disastrous his decision was.
That's a very gentle word, modify.
And then he lies about the Trump administration to try to put the blame on them when he, in fact, was doing the opposite of what they told him to do.
That's right. And this is a disqualifying series of really crimes, lies, and venal decisions that should disqualify him from higher office, even from running for governor again, because it is at these times that leaders are tested. And as I said before, there are many governors and health officials in the federal government as well who have made mistakes, mistakes about masks, mistakes about testing. We're in new territory here, and we're constantly learning new things about this virus. But there's a difference between making a mistake and selling out.
If you have a state government which is methodically doing the wrong thing for senior citizens on Medicare and Medicaid, aren't there some grounds for considering putting that state's health system in a receivership and having somebody appointed to run it who is not part of the corruption and not part of the dishonesty?
Well, that's a possibility, but certainly the public should demand a health department that looks out for the public, looks out for patients, rather than simply kowtowing to the highest bidder, which is what happened here. Let me just point out that despite the fact that New York is known as one of the hospital capitals of the nation, New York hospitals have higher than average infection rates. And they have those higher than average infection rates because the state health department doesn't want to ask the hospitals to do what they call too much, to clean up, to make their hospitals safer, to reduce the infection rates. So patients have to tolerate high infection rates because the hospital industry is so powerful in this state. That means when you go in for a knee replacement or a hip replacement or a bypass, you are at higher risk of getting a deadly infection.
Yet some of the most famous hospitals in America are in New York City.
That's right. New York Presbyterian, for example, Hospital for Special Surgery. But even New York Presbyterian, which is rated in the top 10 in the nation, the highest in New York, it still has only average infection rates. You'd think that would be a place where you could go and be assured that you are getting the safest care. Not true.
That's astonishing. Is this in part of a much larger general aura of corruption, which infects the city and state governments?
I can only address state government, and I can tell you in the state government, money talks. And if you go to a political dinner, for example, the paid lobbyist, Ken Raske, who runs the Greater New York Hospital Association, the industry lobby, he is always seated at the governor's table, often right next to the governor, the prized seat. This is a man who is paid $8 million a year. And he's a lobbyist. He hasn't cured anything. He hasn't developed the next vaccine. He doesn't perform life-saving surgeries. He's a lobbyist. And he's paid $8 million a year. Think what he must be getting from the government and the governor for those hospitals.
Because of the nature of the news media, they are then shaped by the disaster in New York. And then they want to deal with the entire country as though it was as bad as New York, when in fact New York handled COVID-19 dramatically worse.
Yes, and it's really quite stunning to see how much higher the death rate is from this disease in New York than in the rest of the nation. It's disturbing. It's very troubling. And there are many reasons for that. One is that we know that obesity, diabetes, hypertension, those comorbidities make it less likely that a patient who catches the coronavirus will survive. And those particular comorbidities are very prevalent in New York, especially in minority communities. But we also know that's true in many other parts of the nation. Louisiana, the whole southern obesity belt that runs from Virginia and the Carolinas across Louisiana and into Texas. We know it's true in Illinois. We know it's true in Michigan. But that only partially explains it. It also has to be explained in part by the disarray in New York hospitals.
And does that disarray exist because of the lack of any kind of effective state health program?
A very ineffective state health department. And don't forget, over the years, Cuomo left New York very vulnerable to the coronavirus. He consistently reduced the number of hospital beds across the state, closing hospitals. He also paid hospitals far less to take care of Medicaid patients than any other state in the nation. It was a big promise them everything, deliver very little. He wanted to expand Medicaid as rapidly as possible and tell every New Yorker, you can have free health care. But then when it came to paying the hospitals, the reimbursement rates were so low that public hospitals and hospitals that serve low-income communities literally were operating in the most dire austerity environment. And now you see it. They're hit with a pandemic, and they have too little of all the things they need.
Your new book, The Next Pandemic, talks about what should happen.
It's quite clear that our enemies have been watching, how America has been clobbered by this virus. And of course, our enemies are saying, look at what a highly contagious and relatively untreatable virus can do to the biggest superpower in the world. Who needs intercontinental missiles when all you need is a germ? So it's obvious that the risk of some sort of germ attack is increasing. Security experts are warning of that. So I took a look at how are we doing? How well prepared are we compared with 2 years ago, 10 years ago? And I have to say that after two decades of real neglect under presidents from both parties, ever since about 2004, the president has turned this around, and it is remarkable. Think about it, Mr. Speaker. In the midst of marshaling resources to treat patients in a pandemic, marshaling the private sector, FEMA, the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers, the governors, and the private sector, of course, to produce ventilators, to build field hospitals, to deliver care directly to patients, in the midst of all that, and it's been an amazing achievement on the president's part, he has also, in the matter of 3 months, dramatically increased our preparedness for any kind of germ attack. We suddenly have a U.S. strategic national stockpile that's actually going to be stocked. When you look at what's happened over the last 2 decades, the federal health administrators, the bureaucracy, failed to do that. They were much more interested in conducting health programs in 49 other countries than in preparing the U.S. for some sort of health crisis, and it showed.
Wasn't part of that because the Obama administration made a deliberate decision not to replace the equipment that had been used up in SARS?
Yes, they failed to replace the masks and other equipment. So when Secretary Azar looked at how many N95 masks do we have, a mere 13 million. By August, by the way, we will have 300 million in that stockpile. And the target number eventually is a billion. So they have the stockpile stocked. Hospital capacity, this is an amazing story. I remember when the previous CDC Director of Public Health, Ali Khan, said this nation doesn't have enough bed capacity for even a bad flu season, much less a biological attack. Yet he did nothing about it. What has the president done? He brought in the Army Corps of Engineers, and he erected surge capacity all over the country, field hospitals. Those aren't disappearing. They can be staffed and in operation in less than 2 weeks. So we now have a permanent method of surging to meet a pandemic, a second wave of coronavirus, or even a germ warfare attack.
I don't think there's any place in the country where we ever ran out of intensive care units.
We didn't run out of units or ventilators, by the way. The president proudly said in the Rose Garden one day recently, every American who needed a ventilator got a ventilator. That was in itself an amazing achievement. We're now supplying ventilators to much of the world, sending them to Mexico, Russia, and other places. That's how many ventilators we now have. The most important thing he did was to address the medical supply chain. When the pandemic began, China was the number one supplier of imported surgical masks, goggles, generic antibiotics like tetracycline, and the second biggest source of imported ventilators and hand sanitizers, alcohol, all the things you need to treat these patients. But the president just signed an arrangement to manufacture many of these items, including the raw materials for pharmaceutical drugs, in the United States. He is turning that around because we do not want to be dependent on our enemies for the things we need to stay alive.
I agree with you that we're making progress pretty rapidly right now.
I think our biggest need to fight another pandemic, and you know these viruses will be winging their way to our part of the globe again. They're occurring with increasing frequency, SARS, MERS, swine flu, all of these viruses that originate in animals. Now we're in a global environment and they're arriving with alarming frequency. So we do need a way to detect them very early. And that is probably the missing element that we need to invest in, which is a kind of surveillance testing. So when any private or public lab is doing routine tests, blood tests, urine tests, they also start looking for a newly arriving virus anonymously. They just sampled the tests. Is there something in all of these samples that we should be aware of? And that will allow us to know that a disease has entered the United States before people start rushing to the emergency room.
I might mention to you, Betsy, we did a podcast a couple of weeks ago with Blue Dot. They have a worldwide tracking system, and they first alerted their clients about what was going on in Wuhan in the last day of 2019. They were well ahead of CDC or anybody else. They're the kind of advanced surveillance you're describing, where you begin to pick up all sorts of anonymized data.
We were talking about what else needs to be done to prepare us for a second coronavirus wave or some other viral pandemic or even a germ warfare attack. And I noticed when the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, issued their guidelines a couple of weeks ago on how to reopen the economy, I read those guidelines, Mr. Speaker, and I said, these could have been written 50 or even 100 years ago. For example, they were talking about desks in schools or in a workplace, and they said, place the desks 6 feet apart and open up the windows for ventilation, right? And I thought, well, what about all the technologies we have today that enable us to provide a far safer environment, whether we can open the windows and put the desk 6 feet apart or not? What about antimicrobial keyboards? What about antimicrobial coatings for surfaces on desks? We have devices now that can be inserted into the air conditioning system to automatically deactivate viruses in the air and destroy viral load on surfaces. These things are already being used in food production plants, in hospital operating rooms. They can be brought into the workplace to make going back to work or going back to school, for that matter, much safer. I would urge the CDC to get on board with 21st century technology.
I think that's a very important point. I've been very disappointed in the absence of imagination in thinking through how we can apply all the different technological breakthroughs that enable us to really dramatically accelerate both our understanding of a particular disease, but also how people can be safe.
If you look at sports teams' locker rooms, they're using these technologies because if one of their professional football players develops an infection, whoa, they're losing millions of dollars. So they're using these coatings on all their training equipment. They're destroying viruses in the air and making sure they have a clean environment. We could be doing those same things. And I'll tell you, I learned something curious but troubling. When you talk to federal agencies, if you're a scientist in the academic world or in government, you can pick up the phone and talk to these regulators anytime. But if you work for the private sector, you have to wait for vendor day, believe it or not, because you have this scarlet letter on your forehead. You're in the world of commerce. We have to break down that barrier.
Oh, I think that's right. I'll tell you, you would be doing the country a real service if over the next month or two, you were to pull together 10 or 15 examples of the kind of existing practical common sense breakthroughs that government hasn't discovered yet.
Some of them are in my new book, The Next Pandemic.
That's great. I do think this is a very important point. And I think, frankly, in some ways you can sense the degree to which the Center for Disease Control has begun to get sort of a half step behind the modern world, both in the way they gather information and in the way they tried to develop the original tests, and in the attitude of over-control, which seems to afflict all large bureaucracies. It would be a very good idea for the Department of Health and Human Services to create something comparable to the way in which the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency reaches out on a regular basis to the commercial world to try to find the kind of things that are being developed that may not on the surface have any direct relationship but may provide dramatic empowerment. So I think that's a very important part of this and could be a significant part of how we plan for handling starting in the fall. The truth is we may well have various biological challenges coming from almost anywhere, not just South Asia. Are there technologies, just as we have things to fireproof our homes and things to make our cars safer, are there ways that we can actually develop a dramatically safer society by using all of these new emerging technologies?
And the answer is we can. And now that our businesses, unfortunately, have experienced firsthand the devastating financial cost of having to shut down because of a virus, they will see that investing in these technologies to make their workplace safer is a win-win. If no virus attacks, they're going to have lower absenteeism and a healthier workforce anyway. And if the virus does attack, they can continue to operate because they have a safeguard for their employees.
That's exactly right. Now, I like this approach very, very much. And I think it's something that Vice President Pence's task force should take very seriously as an entire new way of thinking about creating a pandemic-free America. And that's really what we're talking about. I want to thank you, as always, when we get a chance to talk with you. You're amazingly informed and insightful. And I hope that you do very, very well with the next pandemic. I encourage all of our listeners to get a copy of it and to recognize that you have now, for a quite long time, been a key player in trying to make this country a better place. And I think you are once again playing that role. So this has been very educational and very helpful. And I'm very grateful that you would take the time to share with all of us the things that you've learned, particularly about New York, but also about the whole process of dealing with the next pandemic.
Well, it's an honor to be in any program with you. You are a national treasure, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Thank you to my guest, Dr. Betsy McCoy. You can read more about how New York mishandled the pandemic on our show page at newsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers, and our producer is Garnsey Sloan. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. Please email me with your questions at gingrich360.com/questions. I'll answer them in future episodes. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcast and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, on May 30th, the SpaceX Falcon 9 and NASA launched a manned space mission. The launch brings a new era of space exploration to the space coast of Florida. This historic mission is the first launch from U.S. soil since the conclusion of the space shuttle program. I thought this is a great opportunity to discuss the future of space exploration and space as an infrastructure investment. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.